Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm now in Isaiah chapter 11, which I will call the righteous reign of the branch. In our last chapter, chapter 10, Isaiah has prophesied doom and gloom on Assyria, and now he starts in verses 1 through 3 in chapter 11. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of power, the Spirit of knowledge and of fear of the Lord, and he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide by what he hears with his ears. Now this is the famous shoot prophecy or branch prophecy of Isaiah. Jesus is called a branch in several parts of the Old Testament scriptures, which I will point out to in just a minute. But first of all, let's look at the agricultural phenomenon which Isaiah was referring to. If you take a tree and chop it down, leaving a stump, the next year you'll see a little tiny green little branch shooting out from the edge of that stump because the tree doesn't like to die. And so that's the metaphor here. A shoot will come out from the stump of Jesse. Now a shoot is small, it's tender, it's weak, and of course the Messiah. He wasn't born like a king in the house of David. He was born of a poor woman and her carpenter wife. He was born of a poor woman, the Virgin Mary, and her carpenter husband. Now, how do we know that this shoot which comes up from the stump of Jesse is referring to the Messiah? Well, first of all, Jesse, the house of Jesse, is David's house because David was the son of Jesse. And, of course, Jesus is well known as being in the house of David. And not only that, Paul quotes Isaiah 11:1 in Romans 15:12, just proving that these verses refer to the Messiah. Romans 15:12, Paul says, and again, Isaiah says, the root of Jesse will appear, the one who rises to rule the Gentiles. The Gentiles will hope in him. Now, Isaiah didn't say anything about the Gentiles, but he did talk about the root of Jesse will appear, will come up. Now, Paul says root instead of shoot, and that kind of perplexed me when I first read that. Here's some options as to how we can explain that. Option number one, the stump is the root, and the shoot sticking out from the stump, the root, are both considered the root. So you look at the whole thing, the whole tree stump there, and it's a tree stump with a shoot sticking out of it. So David is saying the root of Jesse will appear, referring to the stump and the shoot together. I don't think that's a good option. I think Ellicott's solution is the best. He says the root is not the stump, but the root is the first shoot that comes out of the stump. In fact, Ellicott translates this as the root shoot. So Isaiah says a shoot will come out of the stump. Paul says the root of Jesse will appear. Paul is referring to that same shoot that Isaiah is referring to, the first shoot that comes out of the stump. Then there's another possibility. When Paul quotes Isaiah's prophecy in Romans 15:12, and he's saying the root of Jesse will appear, he's referring to Jesus as being the eternal root of Jesse because Jesus in his divine nature was eternal. I think that's a stretch. I like Ellicott's answer the best. This is talking about the first shoot out of the stump. At any rate, we do know that this shoot is the Messiah. Everybody agrees with that. Now, translation issue here. The word shoot here in verse 1, Isaiah 11, is sometimes translated as branch, for example, in the Contemporary English Version, the Good News Translation, the New Heart English Bible. However, the Hebrew word for shoot in Isaiah 11:1 isn't the same word used for branch elsewhere, as Ellicott points out. But Ellicott then says, but the thought is the same, and it really is. Isaiah 11:1, the Hebrew word is netzer, in Zechariah 3:8, in these other verses I'm going to quote you in just a minute, the word is tzamach. Two different words, but they mean the same thing. Now, throughout the scriptures, Jesus is sometimes called the root, and sometimes he's called the shoot, or the branch. And again, that brings up the same problem. Well, I've already mentioned my options there. When Jesus is referred to as the root, it could be the reference is to the root with the little shoot growing out of it. Or it could be that the root is the first shoot, the beginning shoot that comes out of the stump. Well, let's look at the places where Jesus is called the root right here in this chapter, Isaiah 11:10. On that day, the root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the peoples. Revelation 5:5, then one of the elders said to me, stop crying. Look, the lion from the tribe of Judah, the root of David. Revelation 22:16, I, Jesus, have sent my angel to attest these things to you for the churches. I am the root and the offspring of David. And I've already quoted to you Romans 15:12 from Paul. And again, Isaiah says, the root of Jesse will appear, the one who rises to rule the Gentiles. The Gentiles will hope in him. So Jesus is referred to as the root in the scriptures. He is also referred to as the branch. Zechariah 3:8, "Listen, Joshua, the high priest, you and your colleagues sitting before you." Now this is Joshua, the post-exilic Joshua. This is not the Joshua of the Judges, the priest for the returning exilees from Babylon. "Listen, Joshua, the high priest, you and your colleagues sitting before you. Indeed, these men are a sign that I am about to bring my servant, the branch." That's obviously referring to Jesus. Zechariah 6:12, "You're to tell him, this is what the Lord of hosts says. Here is a man whose name is Branch. He will branch out from his place and build the Lord's temple." Holman Christian Study Bible has "his" capitalized because it's referring to the Messiah. Isaiah 4:2, "On that day the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious." So Isaiah has already talked about the branch in a previous chapter, chapter 4. Jeremiah also mentions the branch, Jeremiah 33, verse 15. "In those days and at that time I will cause a righteous branch to sprout up for David, and he will administer justice and righteousness in the land." Likewise, in Jeremiah 23, verse 5, "The days are coming," this is the Lord's declaration, "when I will raise up a righteous branch of David. He will reign wisely as king and administer justice and righteousness in the land." So, Jesus is going to come out of the stump of Jesse, the root of Jesse. He's going to be in the house of David, and he's going to be the Messiah. Now, let's look at this image of the stump. The house of Jesse, the house of David, was a pathetic stump at the time of Jesus' birth. Zedekiah, the last king, had died in exile in Babylon. Now, Jesse's house was not only a stump at the end of his dynasty, it was a stump at the beginning, too. He was an unknown shepherd in Bethlehem. So, the Messiah came out of lowly origins. In verse 2, however, Isaiah says, "The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him." That, of course, is the Holy Spirit, capitalized in the Holman Christian Study Bible and the NIV. "The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding." And, of course, we saw that when Jesus disputed with the learned Pharisees. He whipped them every single time. He did better than even Jordan Peterson could do. So the Spirit of wisdom and understanding will be on Jesus, the Spirit of counsel and of power. Think of all the miracles that Jesus did. Think of all the redemption from sin that Jesus did. Think of all the conquering of Jesus' enemies as the church goes out through the world. Yes, the Spirit of power is on Jesus. And a fear of the Lord, that's reverential fear. Martin Luther said there was two kinds of fear. There was a servile fear, where a slave was scared to do what his master said. Where the slave was scared to not do what the master said because the slave was afraid of punishment, whereas filial fear is a fear that you will not please your father in doing what your father wants. Verse 3, this branch will delight in the fear of the Lord. That's reverential fear, filial fear of the son to the father. Now the branch, Jesus, will not judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide by what he hears with his ears. Jesus was unimpressed with what he saw with his eyes, namely the outward show of religion carried out by the Pharisees, the banquets, the robes, the phylacteries, the trumpeting of alms, the procession of priests. Well, the Pharisees weren't priests, but Jesus wasn't impressed with what the Sadducees were doing either, or what the priestly class was doing. The solemn music, the blasting of trumpets, huge fire on the altar, the antiphonal singing of priests and people, the grandeur of the temple, all of that. Jesus didn't judge by that. He was interested in his kingdom, the church. The Messiah, the branch, will not decide by what he hears with his ears. In other words, the boasting of the Pharisees about how much religion they knew, the Messiah was not interested in that. The branch didn't care. We go now to verse 4 and 5 of Isaiah 11. Isaiah continues, "But with righteousness he," that's the shoot, the branch, "will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. With the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt, and faithfulness the sash around his waist." Now, when the branch is said to judge the needy, that could refer to physical poverty, that neediness, or it could refer to spiritual poverty. It could refer to both. And, of course, judge doesn't mean necessarily a negative judgment. It could be a positive judgment. In fact, the very end of verse 4 says, "With justice he will give decisions for the poor." So there's a judgment, but it's a positive judgment. "For the poor of the earth, he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth." That means he's going to speak and judge. He's going to convict people of sin everywhere. And again, this was fulfilled in the time of the church when Jesus came. "With the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Breath of his lips is just a fancy way of saying with the words that he spoke, he will slay the wicked. And I'm assuming that's the destruction of sinners who had hope for life and salvation without Christ. And he slays all those old men and creates a bunch of new men. Now, of course, some people take that as physical destruction of the wicked at the end of the world. I can't say one way or the other on that. I don't really believe it. We go now to Isaiah 11, verses 6 through 9. Isaiah continues, "The wolf will live with the lamb, the leopard will lie down with the goat, the calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear, their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. The infant will play near the hole of the cobra, and the young child put his hand into the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." Now, we have a bunch of animals mentioned here. They usually hate each other's goats, and they hate human beings, and they'll hurt you. But we got the leopard lying down with a goat instead of eating a goat. He's lying down with a calf instead of eating a calf. You got a lion lying down with a yearling. A yearling is sometimes translated as fatling or a year-old sheep. One translation has it. But whatever it is, the lion's going to eat it. Then the lion will eat straw, and instead of eating meat, he's going to eat grass, straw, just like an ox. He's going to be tamed. The infant will play near a snake's hole, a cobra's hole, and he stick his hand into a snake's nest, and the snake won't even bother to bite the little kid. They, that means all these animals, will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain. Now, what does all this refer to? I'm going to give you four options. Option number one, the church age, and this is what I believe. This is what John Gill believes too. He says, quote, "All of this is, quote, not to be understood literally of the savage creatures as if they should lose their nature and be restored, as it is said, to their paradisiacal estate, which is supposed to be the time of the restitution of all things, but figuratively, of men comparable to wild creatures who through the power of divine grace accompanying the word preached shall become tame, mild, meek, and humble. Such who have been as ravenous wolves have worried Christ's sheep, made havoc of them, breathing out slaughter and threatenings against them, as did Saul, through converting grace become as gentle and harmless as lambs and take up their residence in Christ's fold." Now, I agree with that totally, but there's a school of theology that harps on literalism so much that they look at this and they say, well, these animals are literally going to get along together. That hasn't happened in the church age, so it's not the church age. So it's the millennium, the so-called post-final return of Jesus millennium, the pre-mill millennium, which I suggest to you as a theological construct, this post-second return of Jesus millennium does not exist, in my humble opinion. But let's assume that it does for the sake of argument. In the millennium, there's going to be death. If you study the millennium closely, according to pre-mill theologians, you've got glorified saints in the millennium, and you've also got unglorified people in the millennium, both saints and non-saints. So you've got people that will die. They're living with animals who don't attack each other. I mean, you're going to have a war at the end of the millennium, according to pre-mill theology, and you're telling me the animals aren't going to attack each other in such a state? So I don't believe that for a minute, that Isaiah is referring to a so-called end of the world millennium. What about the future state? Now, in that case, if Isaiah is referring to that, the change in the animals' natures is indeed literal. So notice that if you want to take this passage literally, it doesn't necessarily imply a pre-mill, post-second return millennium, because it could refer to the final state, in which case you still don't have your millennium. In my opinion, it's talking about the church age, but I think it will eventuate in the final state because the church age is the beginning of the new covenant era, which transcends time. It goes all the way to the end of the world and stretches out into eternity future. So then you would have the metaphorical becoming literal. Now, all these animals are said by Isaiah in verse 9 of chapter 11 to not harm or destroy on all my holy mountain. Well, holy mountain is Zion. Zion is a symbol that is used over and over again in the Old Testament. Literally, it's Jerusalem or the city of David within Jerusalem or the city of David plus Mount Moriah in Jerusalem, but it's Jerusalem, and it's a symbol of the government of God's Old Testament people. Well, that symbol morphs, if you will, typologically into the New Zion, the New Testament people of God. We know that because of Hebrews 12:22. The author says, "Instead, you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem." That's the church. "To myriads of angels in festive gathering." As one commentator puts it, the seat of government, my holy mountain, the seat of government, which is in Jerusalem on my holy mountain. The seat of government and of Messiah's throne is put for the whole earth. Jesus is going to rule Jerusalem, but he's also going to rule the whole earth, and that's in the church. Jeremiah 3:17 says, at that time Jerusalem will be called Yahweh's throne, and all the nations will be gathered to it, to the name of Yahweh in Jerusalem. They will cease to follow the stubbornness of their evil hearts. Now, of course, the premillennialists will take that literally, but I believe that this is talking about the government of God. The government of the Messiah will be over the whole church. Jerusalem is a symbol of rule of the Messiah. Now, one more argument that these animals with their changed pacific natures is not referring to the so-called millennium at the end of time. We notice that these animals are going to be peaceful with each other when the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Now, that's very easy to fulfill in the church age. The church is now branched all over the world, even into the remotest corners of China. I've seen it with my own eyes. That doesn't have to be fulfilled in a post-second return millennium. The knowledge of the Lord right now is covering the earth. Isaiah was right. Now, the waters cover the sea, which I think is sort of a redundant way of saying the seas are everywhere. One of my commentators says, as the waters find their way into every cavern of its depths, so Christianity shall pervade every recess of the earth. In other words, as the waters cover the sea, they're covering the sea and then sinking down in all the caves under the sea. And in this way, Christianity shall pervade every recess of the earth, even Xinjiang in western China, where all those Muslims are, even into the Middle East, where all those Muslims are. Christianity will spread, it will spread, it will spread. The knowledge of the Lord, the knowledge of the Lord will make the earth full, just like the oceans cover the planet. We go now to Isaiah 11, verses 10 through 11. In that day the root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the peoples. The nations will rally to him, and his place of rest will be glorious. In that day the Lord will reach out his hand a second time to reclaim the remnant that is left of his people from Assyria, from Lower Egypt, from Upper Egypt, from Cush, from Elam, from Babylonia, from Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. Now, in verse 10, the root of Jesse obviously refers to Jesus, but what is the analogy of Jesus with the root? Option number one, this could refer to Jesus' lowly incarnate nature. He was like a root under the ground. His divinity was hidden to men, just like a root of a tree is hidden to men. The glory of his person, the fullness of his grace, was not immediately obvious. In people's view, Jesus looked mean, abject, contemptible. He was just a carpenter's son. In fact, he was crucified as a criminal. Well, that's one option. Or it could refer to Jesus' pre-existent divine nature, his eternity being before Jesus or any other man or creature. Therefore, he's the root of everything. He's the creator and preserver of all, including Jesse. But I think that option number three is the best. This is referring to the shoot mentioned in verse 1 of this chapter. And as Ellicott says, the root means the first shoot. In that day, the root shoot of Jesse. So this root is the same thing as the shoot. It's the Messiah. Well, however you interpret it, it's referring to Jesus. And Jesus is going to stand as a banner for the peoples, an ensign which a military plants for the troops to rally to and fight under. So Jesus will be there, and Christians will rally to Jesus and fight under his banner. The peoples, of course, is referring to the Gentiles, not just the Jews. So this gospel salvation is not particularistic. It's universal. The nations will rally to the root of Jesse, the shoot of Jesse, and his place of rest will be glorious. That, of course, is referring to the church. The church will be glorious, the glorious church. I wish I could compare that to the sad state of the bare, ruined choirs which consist of the Church of America today, but I have faith that Jesus loves his sheep. He's not going to let anything happen to him, despite how organized Christianity screws things up. Verse 11, in that day the Lord will reach out his hand a second time to reclaim the remnant. Well, when was the first time? Probably the exodus from Egypt, as the pulpit commentator says. The pulpit commentator also said that the place of rest was the church, and then pulpit says that the first time, implicitly referred to here, was the exodus from Egypt. And Poole says that most Jewish and Christian interpreters take it this way. All right, so we're going to take that. When Isaiah says the Lord will reach out a second time, he's implying that the first time was the exodus from Egypt. Now, it could be the return from Babylon was the first time. The second time then would be the remnant returning into the church in the days of the Messiah. But we're going to go with the majority and say that the first time that the Lord reached out his hand was on the Exodus when he saved the Jews under Moses. Now, if that's the first time, what's the second time? Well, the pulpit commentary says it's the return from Babylonia. Problem with that is that there is no symmetry in the analogy. Only two tribes returned from Babylon, but the whole nation returned from Egypt, as Poole points out. Perhaps a minor problem with that option. The second time could be a return of those carried captive by Assyria. For example, Tiglath-Pileser captured northern Israel in 733-732. Shalmaneser V and Sargon II destroyed northern Israel in 722. And Esarhaddon, before 669 BC, scarfed up a few remnants of northern Israel and scattered them to the nations of the Assyrian Empire. So that could be it. So returnees from the Assyrian depredations, returnees from Babylon, it could refer to. But how about this? People in general getting saved during the times of the Messiah, the church age. Poole says that, and that's the one I go with. If Isaiah is referring to literal remnants that are coming back from Assyria and from Babylon, well, if you want to say that, and that's fine, I believe that's a type of something more important, the gathering of the Gentiles and the Jews into the church. Now, the public commentary says that it does refer to people getting saved in the Christian church, but they say a particular people getting saved into the Christian church, namely the Jews. And they say that as a secondary fulfillment, the primary fulfillment is a literal return of people from the Assyrian and Babylonian captivities. Now I'm going to give you a hyper-literal interpretation, a dispensationalist interpretation of this. That interpretation says that in the reign of the Messiah, there will be another exodus of the Jewish people, a second time. He's reached out his hand to deliver the people of Israel the first time in the Exodus described in the Pentateuch. And then there's going to be another Exodus. And that Exodus of the Jewish people will deliver them not only from Egypt, but from all nations to which they have been dispersed. Guzik, a dispensationalist, is speaking like a true dispensationalist here. But the pulpit commentary, and I don't think they were dispensationalists, I don't believe they were, says it is possible that there may be ultimately a further fulfillment in a final gathering together of Israel into their own land. Oh, and here is where the dispensationalists go crazy. 1948. Well, I'll let you believe that if you want to. You notice that all this prophecy is subject to a lot of interpretation because it's not mathematically precise. It's impressive, but it's not like proving a math theorem. Now, all of these people that are coming back into Jerusalem, which I think is symbolic, but we're going to assume that literally, as a type of that which is symbolized, Jews did come back to Israel from Assyria, from Lower Egypt, that is where the Nile River goes into the Mediterranean Sea, from Upper Egypt, that's where the Nile comes out of Ethiopia, from Cush, which is Ethiopia, from Elam, which is the southwestern corner of the Iranian plateau there, the nation, modern-day nation of Iran, if you look in the southwest corner, very famous ancient empire that was there before Persia. From Babylonia, that's, of course, the country between the rivers, between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, present-day Iraq. From Hamath, that's in the north of Israel, basically in Syria, southern Syria. And from the islands of the sea, well, that could refer to islands in the Mediterranean Sea, Corsica, Sardinia, Malta, Cyprus. But it could be the coastlands of the sea, which means that anything in the west, the European islands like England, that's an island, Ireland, Scotland, the Roman Empire, the Turkish Empire, old people speculate all over the place on that. I don't think it really matters. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that there has not been a literal return from all these places, not yet. He's writing in the 1800s. John Gill says there are several places where Christ would have a people in gospel times, and all of these places are mentioned in this verse 11. Now, that's kind of interesting. In Acts 2, verses 9 and 10, we have Parthians, Medes, Elamites, residents of Mesopotamia, Judea, Cappadocia, Pontus in Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt, and the parts of Libya near Cyrene, visitors from Rome. Well, again, that depends on how you interpret the places, but you notice that the Elamites are mentioned, Parthians are mentioned, that's in present-day Iran, Mesopotamia, that's Babylon. Well, that's John Gill. Here's what Poole says. From all places, both far and near, into which either the 10 tribes or the 2 tribes were carried captives, 10 tribes, 722, 2 tribes, and 586, from all of those places, for the places of both their captivities are here named, of which it is needless to discourse particularly, and I agree with that. I don't care about the individual places. It's all symbolic of people returning from the 2 exiles, the 2 main exiles of the Jews, the northern kingdom in 722 under Sargon II and Shalmaneser V, and Judah, the southern 2 tribes, by Babylon in 586 BC. We move now to Isaiah 11, verses 12 through 13. He, that's the Messiah, the shoot, he will raise a banner for the nations and gather the exiles of Israel. He will assemble the scattered people of Judah from the 4 quarters of the earth. Ephraim's jealousy will vanish, and Judah's enemies will be cut off. Ephraim will not be jealous of Judah, nor Judah hostile toward Ephraim. Now I said he is referring to the Messiah. John Gill says it's God the Father. I don't think so. I think it's Jesus, the branch. The exiles will be gathered in verse 12. We've already talked about those exiles. I believe it's the exiles of both north and south. And in fact, this verse says, in the first part of verse 12, the exiles of Israel, that's the northern kingdom. And then in the last part of verse 12, the scattered people of Judah are going to be gathered. That's the southern kingdom. So I think that more or less proves it. They're going to be gathered from the 4 quarters of the earth. That would refer to both the exiles from Israel and Judah because they were scattered all over the world. The exiles to Babylon from Judah, if you just leave northern Israel out of it and just say the exiles from Judah, well, Babylon is not really the 4 quarters of the earth. So I take it to both Israel and Judah. And again, I believe this assembly that's mentioned is in the Church of Christ, not in a post-second return, far-off future, premillennial, millennial reign. Now, in verse 13, Isaiah says that Ephraim's jealousy will vanish. Well, Ephraim was jealous of Judah. Why? Well, because the temple and the Davidic promises of the Messiah all were to be fulfilled in Judah, not Ephraim. Why will they not be jealous? During the times of the Messiah, has all the nations come flocking into the church? Because in Christ, the temple and earthly kingly power aren't going to matter anymore. Who cares if the temple is in Jerusalem, in Judah? Who cares if the Davidic king is ruling in Judah? It doesn't matter anymore. So there's no reason to be jealous anymore. Now, originally, the tabernacle was in Ephraim. As you recall, Joshua ended up putting it up there it ended up in Shechem, which is in northern Israel. Then, as time goes on, the ark ends up in the south. The tabernacle ends up in the south in Jerusalem. If you track the journeys of those 2 holy objects. So yeah, Ephraim's jealous, but not anymore. Because all this Old Testament Jewish stuff doesn't matter anymore. Not in the New Covenant. We go now to Isaiah 11, verses 14 through 16, and we will finish this chapter. They, that's referring to Ephraim and Judah. Ephraim's the northern kingdom of Israel. Judah is the southern kingdom. They will swoop down on the slopes of Philistia to the west. Together they will plunder the people to the east. This is a type of the new Zion, the new Israel, the church. They will lay hands on Edom and Moab, and the Ammonites will be subject to them. The Lord will dry up the gulf of the Egyptian sea. With a scorching wind, he will sweep his hand over the Euphrates River. He will break it up into 7 streams so that men can cross over in sandals. There will be a highway for the remnant of his people that is left from Assyria, as there was for Israel when they came up from Egypt. So we see here visions or metaphors that describe how easy it's going to be to get back into Jerusalem. Of course, that means that the church is going to have people flocking into Jerusalem, the new Zion. They're going to swoop down on all the enemies of Israel. John Gill says that swooping is done by the preaching of the gospel. You got the Philistines to the west. They're on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. And together they, Judah and Ephraim, will plunder the people to the east. That would be the Syrians, the Arabians, the Assyrians, and the Babylonians. And then they, Ephraim and Judah, will lay hands on Edom. That's to the south. So we've got the west, the east, and the south taken care of. The north is not mentioned, the Syrians, but we can assume that the united Ephraim and Judah is going to take care of them too, because all of this is a picture of people flocking into the church. They will lay hands on Edom, which of course is to the south of Israel, all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba. Moab, which is right to the west of the Dead Sea. The Ammonites is right north of the Moabites. They will be subject to Ephraim and Judah. In other words, the pagans there, these are traditional enemies of Israel, But they're not going to be enemies anymore. They're going to be subjected spiritually in the church. The Lord will dry up the gulf of the Egyptian Sea. Now, the Egyptian Sea could either be the Red Sea or the Nile. Well, I'm sure it's the Red Sea because there's an analogy here. The Egyptians crossed a natural boundary in order to get into the Promised Land. Likewise, all this other, the Euphrates drying up and all, is a symbol of the people of Christ coming back into the Promised Land, i.e. the church. Now, some people say that these seven streams, he will break the Egyptian Sea up into seven streams so that men can cross over in sandals, is referring to the Nile because the Nile has seven streams at its mouth flowing into the Mediterranean. I would question that because those rivers break up and change all the time. Maybe that's so. I don't know. But I think the obvious allusion is to the original Exodus, the passing of the Red Sea, the drying up of the Red Sea. You know, God did that with the wind, if you recall. And likewise, just like with the Red Sea, the Euphrates River, which of course was a big natural barrier to the north of Israel, it curled so that it was running mostly east to west in Syria to the northeast of Israel. God's going to break that up into seven streams, which means seven small streams, so people can just walk over those seven streams very easy. The point is, it's easy to get into the new Zion, into the new Jerusalem. There will be a highway for the remnant of his people. Again, a highway running right out of Assyria, so that the Assyrians, the people who were in exile in Assyria, can walk right on that highway and go right back into Israel. That highway will be as there was for Israel when they came up from Egypt. That highway was through the Red Sea, dry. Likewise, the highway from Assyria will be dry going back into Israel. So you see, I've interpreted all this typologically. The Euphrates River is a type of all future impediments to people coming to the new Zion, the church. Remember in the book of Revelation, the new Jerusalem had four gates and they were open all the time. And all the nations came flooding into the new Jerusalem. This is basically the New Testament fulfillment of what Isaiah is talking about here in Isaiah 11. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished with Isaiah 11 and we're ready to go to Isaiah 12, which I will call The Lord is My Strength and My Song. I hope you stay tuned for that audio and I hope you enjoyed this one.